Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to episode 67 of the Intercooler podcast, everybody. This week we're talking about cancelled cars, the promising cars that, for one reason or another, didn't make it into production. Andrew, we're not necessarily talking about concept cars, show cars. It's the stuff that got a bit closer than that.
It's certainly, yeah, I mean, it depends what you mean by a concept car. It's one of those sort of nebulous terms, isn't it? You know, a concept car could be something which is completely and utterly mad and can't move and clearly never will move. And it's just a pure design study. You know, some manufacturers literally use the phrase concept just to showcase their forthcoming production cars. And there'll be a production car, a concept car shown, and then it goes into production, you know, a year later, and you can barely tell the difference between the two. So it's, you know, it's a huge variance in the definition of the word. But no, so we're just going to be talking about cool cars that, for one reason or another, maybe because they were never intended for production, but we think they should have been made, or were absolutely intended for production, but got canned, usually by people wearing suits with calculators in their hands, you know, before they ever made it to a showroom. So it's going to be fun, I think.
Yeah, and some of these were properly slated for productions. You know, they had running prototypes built. Some of them we may have driven ourselves, so there's some good stuff in there. And this is all inspired by a piece that Peter Robinson wrote for the Intercooler app about the Audi Quattro Spider, which was a car. It was a concept. There were prototypes built, and ultimately it never made production. It's a fantastic-looking thing, isn't it? And it was Audi's first sort of ground up sports car. That's what it was intended to be.
Yeah, because I mean, they'd obviously before. So this was 30 years ago. This is 1991. 10 years previous to that, they'd done the Quattro, but that was, you know, very much the sort of, you know, a jazzed up coupe, you know, front engine and everything else. But this was a proper mid engine 2-seat sports car. And I won't spoil it for anybody who hasn't seen it on the app yet. But the reasons, there are a few reasons it didn't make it, but they weren't all just cold, hard, you know, financials. There was a bit of emotional pressure, shall we put it, involved in it. And I just find it fascinating that, you know, in the very hard-nosed world of car making, that, you know, literally, you know, a mum turning to a son and making a comment can, you know, sometimes spell the difference between, you know, something like a car making it or not making it. And it goes back actually to that, another piece that Ben Oliver wrote for us on the app about dynasties and the way that families in car makers, you know, all over the world, from, you know, from Ford in America to BMW in Europe to Hyundai in Korea, South Korea, how the influence of the family still pervades. I find it fascinating. But great cars which never made it is what we're here to talk about today.
That's right. And the Audi Quattro Spider probably does qualify as one of those. It was a promising thing. Mid-engine coupe. It had a removable roof panel, which sort of made sense of the Spider name. Yeah, four-wheel drive, 2.8-litre V6, 170-odd horsepower. It was small, it was light, it got canned. And yeah, if you want to go find out why, it's on the app. There's a great piece by Peter Robinson.
But I mean, somebody on the app wrote, why didn't you say that it was the inspiration for the Audi R8? And Peter quite rightly responded, because it wasn't. But even so, you think what the R8 did for Audi's reputation, its perception around the world. And yet here, you know, thick end of 20 years earlier was a car which would have done the same. Yeah, I mean, you know, the whole, I mean, Audi's been a very successful story, but the whole roadmap, I think, would have looked distinctly different if they'd taken a different decision with that car, because people's perception of Audi would have changed 20 years before it did.
Mm. Yeah, good. All right, well, let's move on then. There are lots of examples, and I think one of the great ones, and there are many reasons why I think this is a great one, partly because we were told it would make production, 250 or so cars built, and there were several different versions, several different prototypes, different concepts, different powertrains. It's an interesting story, and the closer you look, the sort of more interesting it becomes. And it seems like a pity that this car never made it into production. And I'm talking about the Jaguar CX-75. And I'm going to frighten you all by saying now that it was 11 years ago that we first saw that car.
It was 2010, wasn't it?
Yeah. It was a 2010 car. And I mean, it was so ahead of its time, actually, that prototype.
You think where the world has gone since, and just how it saw so much of what was coming all the way back then. You're absolutely right.
So originally it had such a bizarre powertrain, actually, particularly for the time. Four electric motors, one on each wheel, but with two diesel-powered gas turbine engines, to generate the electricity to drive those motors. It had around 800 horsepower, 0 to 60 in 2.5 seconds. Looks fantastic still, doesn't it, the CX-75?
Yeah.
I mean, they ultimately canned it because this was around the P1 918 LaFerrari era, sort of a couple of years before that, wasn't it? What did they say in the end? Was it just that the market conditions weren't right? They didn't think they could sell the number of units.
I think it probably was. I've misunderstood the car. I thought those turbines were range extenders. I thought that they were.
Well, yeah. They were ultimately, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Fine. Good. I'm glad about that. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, you have to look with all these things. You have to look at the context, and you have to look back, particularly to how badly burned Jaguar got with the XJ220. And I think that there was a sort of new reality at Jaguar where, you know, unless something like that could absolutely be guaranteed to succeed, then it wasn't. And also, you know, in engineering terms, I mean, I can remember talking to the guys at the time and they said, yeah, well, and I said, you know, we really do think we can do it. And again, what, turbines? Really? And they said, well, we may have to change this, we may have to change that. And as you say, it went through various different iterations and specifications. To me, it was knowing where Jaguar was positioned in the market, and to an extent still is today, it just struck me as being, you know, a leap too far, and it outstretched the capabilities of what the brand could do at the time. And as you say, with all the other things that were, you know, coming on stream, and which they probably knew about, because okay, this did predate the LaFerrari and the 918 and the P1, but you know, we all knew about them at the time.
Yeah.
And you know, and I think that they could probably just see it all happening again. You know, there was XJ220 back then. Well, there was, you know, McLaren F1s and Bugatti EB110s and, you know, all these incredibly exotic, you know, Ferrari F50s. And, you know, and the XJ220 kind of sank without trace in the face of that kind of competition. And I think they just saw it happening all over again and just thought, we don't need this. And that was the end of it.
Yeah, there was a later version of that car that ditched the turbines, and it had a turbocharged and supercharged 1.6-litre engine, again with the electric motors. So they toyed around with it for a while, didn't they? They were trying to figure out the best way to bring this actually very innovative, very pioneering supercar, hypercar maybe, to market. And ultimately, they canned it in 2012. There was one other version of that car.
Oh, well, the Spectre car.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I'm sure I've spoken about it before. So Williams, and actually it was the Williams, the engineering division of the Williams F1 team, had worked on that project, I think, from day one. And it was the same division that built a handful, I think it was five space frame cars dressed up to look like CX-75s with the Jaguar supercharged V8 plonked in the middle. I'm sure I've spoken about it before on the podcast, but I got to drive one of them out in Mexico, and it was just fantastic. I mean, totally unrepresentative of what the CX-75 was supposed to be
yes,
to begin with.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a lightweight space frame car with a stonking great motor in the middle, and no regulations for it to comply with. And it was just fantastic fun to drive. And the whole point about stunt cars is that they're built to be tough as old boots. They're solid. You can't break them. They also have suspension travel because they need to, you know, they drive over uneven ground, rattle down steps, as the stunt car does in that Bond film, Spectre. And so they're just interesting things to drive. And, of course, they have no driver assistance systems whatsoever. And so, actually, they're about as pure and as stripped back a driving machine as it's possible to get. I loved it. It was a good thing. Right, okay, let's have another one of yours, and then I'll jump into one of mine.
Okay, I'm going to go for the Lamborghini Estoc.
Okay.
Okay. Four-door. 2008, I think, around then, certainly. Yeah, I mean, this predates the Urus hugely, but I just thought it was it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, Ferrari has to date, and we know that they will, but to date, Ferrari has never produced a four-door car. But they had a concept, which was a great-looking thing, called the Pinin, which was, I think that would have been mid-70s. And that was a serious look at a four-door, proper, long-distance executive express from Ferrari. But I think Lamborghini did it better in 2008, and it was a great looking. It was almost kind of like the Espada was back in the early 70s. It just showed that, you know, the form and function don't need to be mutually exclusive goals, and that you can have a fantastic looking car which is practical. And I remember seeing this, and I know that car got really, really close to production. And yeah, I mean, maybe it was a smart move to kill it because the whole SUV thing was coming, and maybe that's why they did it. Maybe they actually thought, oh, no, actually this might be a cool car, but it's actually the wrong kind of car for its era. You know, it had a big V10 up the front and four doors, and you know, there wasn't a lot about it which you didn't like. So yeah, a bit sad that didn't make it.
The whole time that you've been talking about the Lamborghini Estoc, I've been thinking about the Ferrari Pinin, because I when you mentioned it, I just had to Google to have a look at a couple of pictures. It does not look like you would imagine, or certainly not me. If you're not familiar with this car, just go and Google it, everybody. Ferrari Pinin. It looks remarkable. What a pity that thing never got built.
Yeah.
Was that a serious? Ever a serious consideration, or just a disaster?
I think it depends who you talk to. You know, I don't think, given how, you know, small a company Ferrari was back then, even though it had Fiat money, I don't think that you would go and build a car that looks as finished as that, with no intention of ever doing anything with it. I think it was a serious study, but sometimes, you know, so many times with these cars, the only way you can find out whether it should be built or not is to literally go and build one, and then go and show it to lots of people. And say, you know, would you buy one? And then and then once you get the answer to that, then you decide whether to proceed with it or not. So, yeah, I mean, my belief is that it was absolutely built with the intention that should the research come back positively, that it would get built. And I'm guessing that it didn't. And so that was that.
It is interesting, isn't it, that both Lamborghini and Ferrari ultimately did end up building four or five door cars, but they were SUVs. The Urus,
will be an SUV.
That's just sort of indicative, isn't it, of which way the market went and has gone and is going, sadly. Okay, right, let me just Before we go any further, I just want to tell you a little bit about the app, the Intercooler app. Most recently, we've published a piece by Karen Chandock on nature versus nurture in racing drivers. Are great drivers born or made? And he has some interesting views on it. I suppose one of the central points that he makes is that we look at, and perhaps it was Lewis Hamilton, it started with him, but certainly we've seen it with Max Verstappen and some of the younger guys. They're actually coached and groomed to be racing drivers from that high, aren't they? From 3, 4 years old, 5 years old, they're sort of in training to become racing drivers. And so though they might have enormous talent, there is a huge level of nurture going on there. And so Karen just sort of explores that stuff in the piece.
And I thought it was very, very interesting because what he does is he sort of takes us through history and back to the days when, you know, you just had to make it on your own. And then comparing that to, you know, the days of Senna and Schumacher where people would come up through karting and that sort of thing. And then comparing that to the modern day where, you know, F1 teams have their own driver academies and their aim is to snare these people from as young as age as possible. But to me, the really interesting case is Max, because he's got the best of all worlds, because not only has he clearly got a supreme natural talent, but he is being nurtured by his dad.
Mm. Yeah? Also, we should mention his mum.
Yeah.
Who was a world-class kart racer.
Yeah. So the people who provided the nature, the genes,
yeah,
are also the people who are now doing the nurture. So he's just getting like a double dose of it. Yeah, it's a good piece.
Okay, and elsewhere, Henry Catchpole. So you might have seen for all the Car Faction YouTube channel, he drove the three sort of 90s hypercars, the McLaren F1, the Porsche 911 GT1 and the Mercedes CLK GTR. He made a lovely series of films for Car Faction, and he's writing about those cars for us as well. There's some great photography in there.
I did speak to Henry about this, and he absolutely believes that those three cars have never been assessed, shot, driven together by anyone before. It is unique. So if you've not seen it, do go take a look.
It's a three-parter. The first part is up there now, and the second two parts are well on their way. Okay, I'll tell you about one more piece. It's by David Tuig, who's our he's our tame car engineer. And he writes stuff, and I tweeted this. He writes stuff that, certainly not without a whole ton of research, journalists can't really write, because you need the insight of someone who has worked in car engineering for decades to be as expansive, to be as insightful as he is. And most recently, he's written about the cost of taking weight out of a car. And actually, it comes down to a fairly straightforward calculation, doesn't it? If they can remove a kilogram for less than X number of pounds, they'll do it. If it's going to cost more than that, they just won't do it. And he explains why that calculation is different with electric cars. And why that is one of the reasons that electric cars are heavy.
I always just thought it was because, oh, you know, batteries weigh a lot and therefore they have no choice but to be heavy. But it's not. If you go and look at it, there's so much more to that. And it just comes down to a pure financial calculation. And basically, electric cars could be so much lighter than they are, but there is no financial incentive to make them that way. So they're not. And, you know, next time a car manufacturer wails at me, so, oh, well, it weighs 2 tons because it's electric. you know, I gotta have it in the back of my head, well, actually, no, it's not. It weighs 2 tons. It's electric, but it weighs 2 tons because that's the way you choose it to be.
Quite
fascinating,
right.
Fascinating piece.
It is fascinating. Yeah, go and check it out. Okay, let me give you another one of mine.
Go on.
And this is one that I actually drove. And they were deadly serious about making... They gave the impression of being deadly serious about making this thing. It might have just been a PR exercise from day one, and annoyingly, they got a load of PR out of it, and so maybe they consider it job done. But this is Renault Sport. And a few years ago, they put the 2-litre turbo engine from the Mégane into the Clio. They gave it wider tracks, a bit of an aero kit, Cup 2 tyres, and they called it the Renault Sport Clio RS16. It looked fantastic. It had a manual box, 275 horsepower, and the diff as well from the Megane. So Megane drivetrain, Clio body with modifications, wider track, aero and so on. I drove it on a small test track, and it was really good fun to drive. It was really quick, very capable. I think the trouble is it would have cost a small fortune to buy one, to buy a production car. And, you know, if it was, I don't know, maybe it would have been 30 plus thousand pounds. Is it special enough for that money? It probably isn't. And when you look at what Toyota has done more recently with the GR Yaris, you know, it is a bespoke shell, isn't it? That ripping little three-part engine, four-wheel drive. I think probably the RS16 would have been made to look a bit daft by the GR Yaris. It's what I like about Renault is that from time to time, and I just don't think it'll happen again, but over the years they have done really daft things, particularly with their performance cars. And the fact that they couldn't make a business case for a Clio with a Megane engine, it makes it all the more extraordinary that they ever put the V6 Clio into production. It just makes you think, how did that ever get the green light?
Yeah, and two generations of it as well.
Yeah, they did it again.
can I go to completely the other end of the spectrum now?
Go on, let's go for
a leap. This is a car that some people may not have heard of. But all I can tell you is that at the time when it was, I mean, we were told it was going to be built. This was no concept. And if you go and look at it, you'll be amazed that this was actually intended for production. We were just going, oh my goodness, this is just going to, you know, this is going to change everything. I'm talking about the Yamaha OX99-11. Mean anything to you?
Right, I'm going to have to Google this one as well. Yamaha OX99.
Yeah, go and have a look. Stick it in, see what you think. Okay, while Dan's doing that, this was a...
Crikey.
Yes, crikey, yeah. So this was before the McLaren F1. This was about the same time as the Jaguar XJ20. This was a Yamaha. It had a carbon tub. So it would have been the first production car with a carbon tub in it. It had a tandem two-seat bodywork. Yeah. It had a canopy door. So literally the front of the car just flipped open. That was the only way to get in and get out. And it came with a 3.5-litre V12 Formula One engine.
Wow.
I mean, wow. I mean, wouldn't that have just been absolutely astonishing?
God, well, I feel like we've been robbed of this thing now.
Yeah, well, we were. I imagine how I felt at the time.
Wow. I mean, it was a two-seater?
Yeah, it was a tandem, one behind the other.
Bloody hell. It's got a big old air scoop on top, a weird floating sort of wing section across the nose. Wow, that is an interesting machine.
I think they actually built three, and it was, and you know, it was just, again, you know, it may or may not have been the right car, but it was certainly the wrong era. I mean, the early 1990s, you know, all those supercars. The McLaren F1 failed, the Jaguar XJ220 failed, the Chisetta V16T Marauder thing failed, and this failed too. There was a global recession on, and cars like this, frankly, were never going to make it, because the world was a different place when they got built to how it had been when they were conceived. But I often think back to, you know, the bonkers cars that did make it into production, and I just sort of feel a bit sad that the one that in many ways I was most interested to drive didn't. So there's the Yamaha OX99.
That is an extraordinary looking thing.
Isn't it pretty?
I'm not sure
it's pretty either, but I mean, it looks exciting, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah, 3.5-litre F1 V12, 1,000 kilograms. That would have been extraordinary to drive.
Manual box. Yeah.
Oh. Well, there we go. I'm not sure I can rival any of those. Although I will offer you, and again, BMW built a prototype, and they're very open about this car, and they...
I know what you're going to say.
No, you might not.
Oh, really?
Okay, well, let's see if you do know. What am I going to say?
Original M8.
Well, do you know what? I've got two. That was on my list. But first, I was going to talk about the E46 M3 Touring.
Yeah.
And BMW built a running prototype. And there are press shots of it on the BMW press site. And so, you know, it's hardly a secret. But that's an interesting proposition, isn't it? The E46 is a great coupe. It would have been a hell of a leap to do a Touring, given that there wasn't actually a four-door version of that M3. But yeah, I mean that 3.2 litre straight six with a manual box and a state body on top.
That would have been just wonderful.
It's going to be fairly heavy compared to the coupe, isn't it? But well, imagine how in demand a used one of those would be now. Yeah, that would have been quite something. Okay,
well, it's only now that they've finally got around to doing a 3 Series, well, an M3 Touring.
Yeah, it took them a few years, didn't it? But you're right, so the first M8 was on my list as well. 1990, it was going to, supposedly, it's going to have a Paul Roscher V12 in it. Well, 550 horsepower.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was essentially, I might get myself into a huge amount of trouble here. My understanding, if Gordon Murray happens to be listening to this, is that it was essentially, certainly very much related to the engine that ended up going into the F1. What I really liked about this car, the 8 Series was quite a sort of fat and flabby car back then. And it wasn't just, oh, stick a big engine in it and bung an M badge on it. It actually, if you looked at what they tried to do with it, particularly, I mean, they turned it into a two-seater and put all sorts of lightweight bits in it. They really did want to do a proper supercar. And it would have been great. And I guess I always look back when I think of reasons why they didn't do it. And again, you know, there's an elephant in the corner. In the form of the M1, it's, you know, it's original and today only real supercar, and they got their fingers burnt with that. So I think maybe they thought that originally they could do the M8 as a sort of way of getting into that market without spending anything like the money required to do a bespoke car. But my understanding is the reason that it got killed is it still ended up being incredibly expensive. I mean, I read something online like it would have had to have cost twice what a Porsche 911 would have cost. And it could never have stood up as a commercial proposition like that. But again, can you imagine that engine, manual gearbox? Yeah.
It's a pity, isn't it? This is actually a fairly depressing list, all the cars that we've been denied.
It was always going to be, wasn't it? It was always going to be.
I don't think I'd really considered that. Okay, well, I don't feel so bad about the Bugatti that you wanted to talk about. That was never going to exist in my world. But can you tell us a little bit about... You're going to have to pronounce the name for me.
No, you're going to have to pronounce the name.
16C, and then you can do the second part.
Galibier.
Galibier, okay. Right, fine, yeah, Galibier.
I thought it was really cool. So Bugatti had done the Veyron, and we're all sitting there thinking, well, what are they going to do next? Because they spent so much money getting that car to market, and we just thought, well, they can't just do one car. They're going to have to do something else, particularly with that ridiculous powertrain that they spent so much time developing. And then this front engine, four-door, I guess you'd call it a saloon, was shown. And my memory is that although they didn't say, we will put this into production, my memory was that it was absolutely intent on becoming produced. And this was like a sort of, it was almost like a sort of modern Bugatti Royale, wasn't it? This was to luxury saloons what the Veyron had been to traditional supercars. It was just that, and you know, don't turn up to 11, turn it and turn it and turn it, keep going until the dial breaks off in your hand. How can I say it? I quite liked it.
do you know what? I was reading about it before we came on, and reportedly VW execs killed it because they didn't like the way it looked.
Ah, okay.
So you liked the way it looked, did you?
It interested me. It certainly interested me. And I was surprised that they killed it because it struck me as being something that, you know, a second. I thought that they would grow that brand and put it into different areas and different markets, and they didn't.
Interesting. Well, do you know what? On the topic of Bugatti, there's another car, another VW Group car, though it was VW badged, the W12. So it seemed to have several names: W12 Coupe, W12 Nardo, yeah. W12 Synchro, W12 Roadster, but all fundamentally the same car. And I say on the topic of Bugatti because this was, okay, it had a 12-cylinder engine, but in a W configuration. It was mid-engined. All-wheel drive. Do you think that while VW is pondering this, it was also thinking about Bugatti, or do you think one inspired the other ultimately? I mean, there are some striking similarities.
I mean, I don't know, to be honest with you, Dan. I mean, the Bugatti's obviously got 16 cylinders. It came quite a lot later. I mean, it's basically the Bentley engine, or the engine that would go on to power Bentleys would you ever put a mid-engine? I mean, what it did at Nardo, I mean, it went to Nardo and it broke every single road car speed record that there was. In 24 hours, it averaged, inclusive of stops, over 200 miles an hour for 24 hours. It did thick end of 5,000 miles. I mean,
wow.
Yeah, exactly. But for what? I'm not being a snob here. I'm just looking at the sort of commercial realities of the way the world is. And who would have bought that with a Volkswagen badge on it?
That's the reality.
So, I mean, it was an amazing thing. And I can remember thinking, yeah, but why? What are they trying to... What's the purpose of this car? What's it trying to do? Because clearly they're never going to make it. Or if they do make it, they'd have to put, you know, somebody else's badge on it. An interesting thing. Quite a good looking car. Not as good looking, in my view, as the Audi Quattro Spider we talked about earlier. It's 600 horsepower. How fast must it have been to be able to average 200 for 24 hours?
Yeah, I mean, you need a good margin above 200, don't you, for it to sit at, given that you also have to stop and refuel it.
And it must have had a huge tank. Can you imagine? You're one of the drivers. So let's say to average 200, inclusive of all stops, you've got to sit there at, I don't know, between 210 and 220. I've done... Well, no, that's not true. I've done 208 round Nardo. And it's fair to say you've got to have your wits about you. If you are and you're sensible and you're a stable car, it's kind of fine. But, you know, I went out there and I did like a couple of laps, which doesn't take very long when you're traveling that fast. They would have gone out there and they would have done a whole tank, probably quite a big tank. And so you're going along there and you're doing 210, 220 and you're really fast. And then you've got to come in. And that sensation, you must have become so used to doing those speeds that you come in for your pit stop. And by the time you're doing about 70, it must feel like you've stopped. I can remember this, actually. This is a bit of a sideline, but I once did some record breaking for Saab at Talladega. And we were averaging 150-something in whatever they were. Can't remember. 9.3s? 9.5s? Can't remember anything. But being turbocharged whatevers, and we'd just drive around as fast as they possibly can. And the one thing they said to us in our training was, the one thing you have to watch most is you'll get so used to doing these speeds that when you come into the pits... You know, at best, you're going to overshoot. At worst, you're going to run somebody over. So however slowly you think you should come in much, much slower than that. And still, the first time I came in, I just went straight through the pit. Because I'd lost all my ability to judge speed. And that was doing 150-something. Imagine you're doing 210, and then suddenly you've got to go from an hour of doing that to nothing. Anyway.
Interesting, isn't it? It's amazing how quickly the mind adapts to a higher speed.
Yeah,
but we've all experienced it. Well, okay, lots of us will have done when you've driven down a runway really quickly and you're hard on the brakes coming towards the end of the runway, and you think you're about to stop and open the door, and you're still doing 60 miles an hour. It's the strangest thing, and you describe it very well there. So this VW supercar, this was in the Ferdinand Piëch era, wasn't it, where he was determined the Volkswagen could mean much more than people's car. It was under his rule that they built the Phaeton. They did all sorts of stuff that really you just wouldn't expect of a VW-badged car. What do you think was going on there in Piëch's head? Do you think it was just a halo effect that he was aiming for? Or was the...
I think Piëch, I think he probably thought that there wasn't much that if he decided to turn his hand to it, he couldn't do and he couldn't succeed. And I think he thought that the Volkswagen brand, I mean, you know, and again, just look at the history of it. You know, this was the grandson of Ferdinand Porsche, who designed the Beetle, And, you know, I think he probably thought that Volkswagen could be growing into this massive mega brand, and maybe there was some production intent with these things. Or maybe he was just happy, as you say, for these cars to be loss leaders, and for, you know, the stardust that they sprinkled down to sort of, you know, rain on everything else and bring them up by association. I'm not really sure. But I can remember when the Phaeton came out just thinking, well, I'm sure it's a great car, but, you know, people just aren't going to get out of their Mercedeses and their BMWs into a, whatever it would have been, a 50 grand Volkswagen at the time, even if you do put a, you know, a, an enormous engine in it, which they did. And so it proved. So I think it also proved that no one is infallible, up to and including Ferdinand Piëch.
Do you know, there might be another topic to be addressed, another podcast. The sort of blue collar brands that have been able to get away with expanding into very, very different territory and make a success of it.
Give me a for instance.
Ford GT.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good call. It's a good call, isn't it? But okay. It wouldn't have worked if they hadn't won Le Mans.
Exactly right. That's what underpins that car's credibility, isn't it?
Exactly. If they just decided, oh, we're going to go and do this car, it would never, ever work. People would have gone, huh?
Mm. Yeah. It needed that basis. And we know Toyota are planning to do it soon.
Yeah. Yeah. And presumably Peugeot too. Well, they're going to LMH, aren't they? So presumably they will have to produce some kind of road-going car as well.
Okay, we'll keep that in our back pocket then. Good. Okay. Well, unless you've got any other cars.
Always I do.
Okay. Come on then. I don't want to cut you off mid-flow.
No. So I'll be running out of time.
No.
Okay. So Bentley Jawa.
Right. Okay. Let me pull up Google again.
I wouldn't want anyone to think that we don't plan these podcasts.
Bentley. Oh my goodness me. Oh, it looks like a Chinese knockoff, doesn't it?
Oh, don't say that. I love it.
Again, how have I never heard of this car?
The Bentley Jawa was it was basically a Continental GT 10 years before the Continental GT. The idea was of making an affordable Bentley, and I think they built. They actually did build quite a few, but they're all sort of private orders, and I think a stack of them went out to Brunei and places like that. I think certainly the cars that they showed were based on BMW 5 Series. And I thought it was actually a really cool looking car. And I think this was when, obviously, Bentley had a lot of success. Coming back from, you know, that period when it had literally just been abandoned in Rolls, and then we'd had the Mulsanne Turbo R and that sort of thing. And so Bentley was, you know, in the ascendance, but it had kind of, by the mid-1990s, they'd kind of run out of ideas of what to do with it. And the Jawa was a dip in the water just to see what else the Bentley brand could do. And it just struck me as a shame that they didn't see it through, because... So that was 1994. So it was, 3 years later after that, the Volkswagen bought Bentley. And the first thing they do is a mid-sized car. I mean, actually, the Continental GT, you won't remember this because you were barely alive at the time. The Continental GT's codename was MSB, for mid-sized Bentley. And that's the first thing they decided to do when Volkswagen bought Bentley. And actually, I think the Jawa in 1994 was a really, really credible... I think it was done by a bloke called Roy Axe. Credible piece of design, and I personally have liked to have seen it done. Can I give you another one?
Yes, you can.
Mini Rocket Man.
Yes.
You must remember that.
I do, and actually I was talking about it with someone from BMW the other day.
This was actually a mini... It was actually a mini, a proper size mini. It was like two thirds the size of a normal coupe, a hatchback, wasn't it? And as someone who always just thought that the BMW minis, however good a lot of them or some of them are, I just think that they, to an extent and in one regard only, they kind of failed at the first in absolutely, you know, nicking the brand, but not following the design genius, the inspiration behind it. And they sort of dangled this in front of us and they say, look, you know, here's one we could have done, but decided not to. And I just thought that was a bit of a shame, really.
Yeah, so by coincidence, I was talking to somebody about this who knew a bit about it. And I think the issue was that it's crash legislation, all that stuff. There is a BMW designer who was quoted as saying that at the time that the concept car was built, the materials and the techniques didn't exist to make it pass the necessary crash legislation tests, because there were, I guess, only very small crumple zones. It was a tiny little thing, really, wasn't it?
I think it was carbon, wasn't it?
Yeah.
The actual show car, I think it was, and maybe that was the only way they could get it to crash, but I don't know.
Yeah. But it's interesting, isn't it? Because there are smaller, much, much smaller cars than a Mini.
And there were then. You know, I give you the Smart 4-2, and that crashed perfectly well. No,
says a man who knows. No,
I haven't crashed as well.
Okay, fine. So
I don't think
I don't necessarily believe that it would have been impossible to get that thing through a crash test.
No,
and it's a pity, isn't it? Because the idea of actually a properly mini could have been fantastic, particularly for knocking around town. Maybe if they did a hot one. Yeah. Well, okay. Unless you've got any others.
Yeah, I do.
I've got a few. How long is your list?
So there's an Audi Quattro Concept on there. There's a Mercedes C111 on there. I'm only going to talk about one more, only because it's a car that I'm actually quite glad they didn't make. But it is interesting. It is definitely interesting, which is the Porsche 989.
Ah, interesting. Yes. Yeah. You're quite right. And Porsche quite recently. Okay, no, go on. Just tell us about the 989.
The 989 was a Panamera 20 years before the Panamera. This was a four-door coupe, basically with 928 running gear. And, you know, we all saw prototypes. It was absolutely intended for production. They took it very seriously, indeed. But, you know, this would have been produced at about the sort of time that Porsche was getting itself into quite a lot of financial trouble. It wasn't building cars economically. All the cars that it were building, you know, things like, you know, all the cars, you know, the 924 based cars, the 928 cars, the 911s, they're all getting old, long in the tooth. Porsche weren't building their cars economically, and I suspect that this was just a bridge too far. But, you know, that's where we first learned about the idea of a four-door Porsche coupe, for want of a better word. The reason I'm glad it didn't get made is I think I didn't like the way it looked, because it looked kind of like they tried to make it look like a sort of stretch 911.
They did, yeah.
And it just didn't work visually to me at all. And I fear it might have failed. And got Porsche into even more trouble than it was already in. So that's why. But it was good. You know, if you've not seen it, go and look up a Porsche 989. Pictures of it all over the internet. Really, really interesting idea. It's interesting also to me that it took them 20 years before they wanted to, you know, think about revisiting it.
Mm. Yeah, I think you're right about the way that car looks. It's almost stretched 996-y looking, isn't it? With round headlights. Yeah, not a sort of effortlessly pretty car that, but then nor was the first Panamera, was it? Okay, well, unless you want to tell us about any other cancelled cars.
No. Do you know what? Because there are quite a few of them. There are lots in America as well. So maybe we'll save them up and do another podcast about those.
Yeah, and if there are any that you think we're going to miss, let us know and we'll look into them.
There are plenty we've missed, I'm sure.
Yeah,
I'm sure.
No doubt about it. Not least, Porsche quite recently just released images and details of a whole load of cars, sort of design studies that they elected not to put into production, didn't they? And there's some really fascinating stuff in there, so maybe we can dig into those a little bit more. Good. Well, we'll leave that one there. Remember to come back next week. We'll have another podcast for you. But before then, go and download the Intercooler app. Just search the Intercooler, whichever app store you use. Download the app, start your 1 month free trial. We think you'll like it. But yeah, we'll talk to you again next week.
Look forward to it. All the best. Bye-bye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.